Where is the world's largest far-right movement? Well, it's in India, the world's largest country. For almost 2 months, it's also been hosting the world's largest elections, with hundreds of millions of people voting from mid-April until June 1st, 2024. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, are seeking a third term in office. But the BJP is not your ordinary political party. It's actually part of the largest far-right movement in the world. The BJP is part of a whole complex family of affiliated organizations that promote Hindutva, a far-right ideology that advocates for establishing India as a Hindu nation-state and has motivated acts of extremist violence, especially against India's significant Muslim population. Hindutva reaches deep into numerous aspects of Indian culture and popular culture, from poems to cinema and popular music. And there's a name for that kind of pop music, Hindutva pop, or H-pop. It's really catchy pop music. It really is. But it's also pop music that normalizes far-right views and even oftentimes encourages violence against minorities. It's a really powerful and worrying phenomenon, but it's something we can learn from. It's a phenomenon that gives us a window into helping understand what Hindutva is all about. That's why, for this episode of the Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast, Bellingcat journalist Pooja Chaudhary and I spoke with Kunal Parohit, an Indian journalist and the author of H-Pop, The Secretive World of Hindutva Pop Stars. Well, it's really a pleasure to have Kunal Parohit here with us to talk about his latest book.
Hi, Kunal. It's, like Michael said, so nice to have you here with us. For our listeners who may not know Kunal's amazing work that he's been doing for 2 decades now, Kunal is an independent journalist, and he reports on politics, social justice, hate crime, Hindu nationalism, among several other topics. His work has been published on the Hindustan Times, Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy, South China Morning Post, ProPublica, to name a few. And Kunal recently published a book called H-Pop, The Secretive World of Hindutva Pop Stars. And he's joining us today to talk about his book. Welcome, Kunal.
Thank you so much, Pooja. And thank you so much, Michael. I mean, I'm so glad to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
Well, that's great to hear. Thanks for that. When I was first made aware of your work and this book from Pooja, and when she mentioned the title of the book, the subject of the book, I think I almost jumped off of my seat because, and I'm not joking, it was literally that level of excitement, because these are the kinds of topics when researching the far right that I intensely interested in. So just as a first question, I noticed when actually the first few pages of your book, the opening anecdote of the book that you have in your intro, it's about, without spoiling it too much for listeners before you answer, it's about a procession in a small Indian city that seldom gets news headlines. But you say in the book that it was kind of the incident that led you to writing the book itself. Can you recount for listeners a bit about that anecdote, that episode?
I mean, of course, I say this in the book as well. I think there are these sort of moments in journalism when you accidentally stumble upon stories. You don't go out seeking them, but while you're in the process of maybe reporting a story, you stumble upon a second story, and the second story then seems to be or becomes the bigger, the more important, and the more fascinating story, which is precisely what happened with me in this case as well, because I was originally meant to be in this small town in central India, this town called Gumla. And essentially in Gumla, I was investigating a hate crime that had happened. But what happened was, on the basis of the news reporting that had already been done, and mind you, I was visiting the town a year after the hate crime, so it wasn't the sort of quick response journalism that we often see around these issues. This was very purposefully a delayed visit because I really wanted to understand it from various angles and perspectives. And when I went down there, what I realized was the original hate crime that I had gone to cover was the lynching of a 19, 20-year-old Muslim young man in that town. And the ostensible reason given for the hate crime in the media reporting was that, you know, he was speaking to a Hindu girl who was his friend, and a group of Hindus objected to that conversation because they felt that, you know, here was a Muslim who was trying to lure that Hindu girl out of her religion, trying to, you know, sort of get her to marry him and then convert her into Islam, which is this sort of conspiracy theory that Hindu nationalists keep reiterating. So that essentially was, you know, was what the newspapers reported to be the reason behind his lynching. Except when I went to town, I went to that town and I sort of started asking people, what I realized was that was also the day when there is, you know, the when it was the birth of Lord Ram, who's now one of the most popular sort of Hindu gods in the country, and who's worshipped and revered by millions and millions of people across the globe, and on that day, like always, there is a procession of tens of thousands of people, which would make its way across different parts of that town. And it would be a day-long procession. So it would start, say, sometime in the afternoon. It would go on till late in the night, and it would cross different parts of the town. And on that particular day, when it was crossing the main mosque of that town, because, you know, the town also had a sizable Muslim population, when it entered the lane where the mosque was, the people in the procession had a very different energy to them. You know, they were rather boisterous. They were very aggressive, almost menacing in the way that they were approaching the mosque. And you know, this was very new to the town because generally, and this is a tradition for years and years and for decades, where that very procession every year would come before the mosque and the locals would welcome it. The local Muslims would come out and welcome the procession. And then the procession would, you know, so it was a syncretic tradition between the two communities.
Yeah. It wasn't adversarial.
It never was adversarial. But that particular year, there was something that had made it adversarial. And when I went and investigated a year later, and when I spoke to a number of people who were present on the spot, initially, no one could really tell what had changed or what had happened. And then one person, you know, sort of almost accidentally and you know, on second thought said, oh, you know, but there was also this music they played, which I think, you know, roused people's emotions. And I said, wait, what kind of music? What do you mean? And you know, then he told me the lyrics of the songs, and the lyrics of the song that was being played that evening were to the effect, you know, toss the skull cap off the Muslim's head. You know, and that was the song that the procession played as soon as they were close to the mosque. And that song really triggered tensions between the two communities. And so in that moment, there was almost a clash between you know, these tens of thousands of Hindus and the handful of Muslims who had gathered there. Except that the police quickly intervened and ensured that there was no violence. But after the procession ended, a few people who were part of that procession were going back home, and when they saw you know, the 19-year-old Muslim boy talking to his Hindu girl, Hindu friend, they immediately thought of it as, you know, as this sort of Hindu nationalist conspiracy about him luring the girl away, and they activated the hate. And they sought to lynch him right then and there, and they succeeded in doing that. So that is how I sort of accidentally stumbled upon what I call the world of Hindutva pop and the world of Hindutva pop stars.
It's a fascinating world, I can tell you that.
So, Kunal, I feel like this question is asking you to do several dissertations at once and a few books on top, but I think I should ask, just for our audience, what exactly is Hindutva and why it's important to talk about it? And can you then tell us a little bit about, you know, how that has now progressed in the form of music?
Right. You're absolutely right. It feels like, my time back doing my master's in SOAS in London and writing all of these essays and dissertations. But essentially, for a global audience, especially, Hindutva is almost this sort of homegrown form of Hindu supremacy in India, which essentially believes that Hindus are superior to people of all other faiths that are present in the country, and that the Hindus are sort of the original claimant to everything, which is what they call the Hindu Rashtra, which is the Hindu nation. And hence that sense of supremacy must be bestowed upon the Hindus again. The movement really, it's not new in that sense, because it's at least a century or even more old in that sense, because some of the earliest votaries of Hindutva, were people in the early 20th century, for instance, right? And the Hindutva sort of fountainhead of Hindutva thought, which is the RSS, was also born around that time. It's this sort of belief that, that the Hindu identity, in a sense, is the identity that can lay its rights over India, at the cost of other religions, at the cost of other religious minorities, for you to be an Indian, you have to accept Hinduism, and you have to accept the Hindu way of living. They've made it almost, mutually non-exclusive in that sense, where you can't necessarily claim to be as much of an Indian if you're a Muslim or a Christian. It's that sense of supremacy that Hindutva thought really carries. And as a result, in a sense, what some of the earliest ideologues of Hindutva thought have argued is that people who are of different faiths, for instance, Christians and Muslims, are all originally Hindus, and hence, the right thing for them to do, for them to be fully integrated into the country and into its social ethos, is to come back, almost sort of come back to their mother religion, which is Hinduism. That's sort of the train of thought that Hindutva has honestly always, foundationally operated out of. And then, of course, Hindutva has also flourished, and it's not a benign sounding sort of, political ideology, but it also is a political ideology which inherently makes enemies out of people of different religions. Right. It inherently has. And as I said, some of the earliest ideologues have done this, is that they've inherently painted people of other religions to be enemies of the Hindus, for instance, Muslims and Christians.
Sorry. And are these some of the themes that are also used in the songs?
Well, essentially, yes. But they're never spelt out as such. They're never spelt out to be sort of Hindutva songs per se, where they don't say that, we're working, for the RSS or so on. What they do, and which is what makes it so potent and sort of dangerous, this world of Hindutva pop, is that they take all of these essential themes of Hindutva and try and create popular culture content around it. So what they will tell you, for instance, is, again, as I said, right, they will look at possibly a case of, a domestic tiff between a Muslim man and a Hindu, Hindu girlfriend or a Hindu wife or a Hindu partner, where, it's resulted in say, violence against, the Hindu woman in that case. And they will, all of these songs, for instance, or some of the singers will look at cases like that, and then they'll try and connect the dots to, the Hindutva way of thinking, which is that, we were always telling you that Hindutva men, that, Muslim men are out to do this. Muslim men are inherently out to lure, the Hindu women to convert them. And if they don't agree, to then, commit acts of, sort of, you know, inhuman violence upon them. So they'll try and do that. They'll try and do that with essentially everything. I remember when the country had, you know, these protests in 2020 against what the Modi government had brought, which was a very discriminatory citizenship act, you know, where it was fast tracking the citizenship of non-Muslim refugees from you know, our neighboring countries in around India. When there were a lot of people who were out on the streets protesting it, especially Muslims who were protesting it, some of these pop stars created songs. And the character that I talk about in my book, this singer named Kavi Singh, she created this song which essentially portrayed all of these protesters, you know, especially the Muslims, to be really sort of traitors to the nation. And then, you know, she linked it to this Hindu fear, this Hindutva line of thinking that Muslims are engaged in this conspiracy to outnumber the Hindus in India. So Hindus are constantly shrinking and Muslims are constantly increasing. And a result of that, you know, shrinking of the Hindu population is that Muslims are today out on the streets protesting laws that are brought in by the government. So, you know, how it's interesting how they marry current affairs and how they marry things that are happening in the present with some of the most sort of original lines of thinking around Hindutva thought. And that is what is so fascinating and powerful about Hindutva pop culture.
Right. And elections are going on in India right now, like the voting is underway. And could you tell us if you've noticed anything about Hindutva pop in the current election season that sticks out? What role do these singers play before elections? And are there also politicians who, because I know this BJP MLA called T. Raja Singh, which I think he's the most popular one who uses you know, Hindutva songs. He sings them himself as well. So with regard to elections, what role do these singers play? And if you can talk about the current election season, what you've noticed.
I mean, absolutely. So one of the things that, you know, we've seen, and I've been tracking this very closely because, you know, my book came out only in November, and I really wanted to see how long does Hindutva pop continue to be a powerful weapon for mobilization? And guess what? I mean, you know, we're in bang in the middle of elections, and what we're seeing is in some ways increasing use of a Hindutva pop culture. And this is not just songs. This is, you know, this is poetry, this is books, but this is also cinema. So my book focused on the role of music, the role of poetry, and the role of literature. All of these were being weaponized by the Hindu right wing to spread the message of Hindutva. But increasingly, we're also seeing the rise of the next frontier of sorts, which is Hindutva cinema, right? Where cinema, where movies are being weaponized to essentially, again, stoke the Hindutva line, to popularize it and to radicalize people without really them being told that this is political messaging. You know, it's presented as a sort of benign cinema in some ways almost. So what we're seeing in this election season is you know, the release of movies like those, which again, you know, sort of take these popular, you know, conspiracy theories and depict them on the screen. There's one movie which sort of describes how, you know, Rohingyas and Muslims are conspiring to enter India. And as I said, right, again, increase the population of Muslims in India and overthrow the rule of Narendra Modi. So, you know, they've got characters who are based on the prime minister. Sometimes they very openly take Modi's name and they present him to be sort of this person who is protecting the Hindus and so on. So you're seeing that kind of cinema develop. As far as music is concerned, we've seen a very dramatically high usage of Hindutva songs in this election season. You know, what we're seeing is some of the most potent narratives and some of the, you know, most catchy and popular slogans of this election season are all being set by songs. Right. And it might sound fascinating to people that the world's largest democracy sort of operates so closely around songs. But for instance, one of the things that, you know, that the prime minister and everyone in his party keeps saying is this line, which was originally from a song that was released in December last year, which essentially said the people who've brought Ram back are the ones that we should be voting back to power, right? And then this is, of course, in reference to the Ram temple that was inaugurated in January by Prime Minister Modi. So, you know, that has become a slogan now. So we're also seeing, for instance, the character on whom I focus in the book, Kavi Singh. She has come out with this with a song where she's asking her millions of followers online to back Narendra Modi and to bring him to power again. She's again released another song which talks of how once he comes back to power, India will become a Hindu Rashtra, which is a Hindu first nation. So we're increasingly seeing these attempts grow more and more and become more and more brazen. The other quick addition that I also want to make is that the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's party, the BJP, have increasingly been adopting a very brazen Hindutva line of campaigning, where they're actually using the exact same rhetoric that the Hindutva pop stars would use against Muslims and so on, which is now that the Prime Minister is calling them infiltrators, calling them people, you know, who are grabbing the share of resources that actually belong to Hindus and so on. So I feel like, you know, it's not just Hindutva pop, but it's also the rhetoric that Hindutva pop used, which is now increasingly growing its footprint in the election season right now.
So Kunal, you mentioned this single called Kavi Singh, and I think your book starts off with talking about her journey. And I found out of everyone in the all the characters in your book, I found her to be most fascinating because of the role her father played in her journey and, you know, all the men around her shaping how she should be in her career. And without giving, you know, too much details of how, you know, she had this popularity, which was sort of short-lived, but I'm seeing now that she's coming up with new songs. But you also later tell us in the book that it's an industry unsurprisingly, dominated by men. And, you know, there are shows where there are some female lineups, maybe just one, and they're even forgotten to get an introduction by their male counterparts. Could you tell us about the role of women in Hindutva pop?
Absolutely. I mean, so what's fascinating is that you know, the way the role of women in Hindutva pop, in that world of Hindutva pop stars has been, actually closely resembles the way women in general have been a part of the Hindutva movement, which is that, you know, for all of these years, for decades and decades, we've seen some women rise to prominence within the Hindutva movement on the basis of their oratory, on the basis of their sort of firebrand image that they cultivate. But they never really rise to the leadership of the movement. The leadership is still firmly in the hands of men. You know, you look at the BJP now, where Narendra Modi is not, you know, he's not the BJP party chief, but the top rung of the party is still male dominated, essentially. Right. You look at his government as well, and it's the same. The RSS, which is the fountainhead of Hindutva thought, doesn't have any women in its top to mid leadership at all. In fact, you know, one would have to look very closely to even find women in its sort of leadership positions. So what we're seeing is that that same essentially has been replicated in the Hindutva world of pop stars and pop culture, where, you know, there are women like Kavi Singh who exist maybe in very small and infrequent numbers when you look at all of the artists. But you know, they're not the most prominent of them at all. And I think a part of it is because for decades and decades, you know, the country and our society has also grown used to the idea of this sort of masculine, strong man, you know, delivering hate speeches and goading you to, you know, towards emotions of fear and anger towards other communities. And women have traditionally felt it difficult to break into that mold. Also, as I said, because, you know, institutionally, they haven't been given spaces within the Hindutva movement. Which is really essentially what drew me to Kavi Singh, because I found it fascinating that in this sort of male-dominated masculine space, here was this, you know, 20, 23-year-old, 22-year-old woman who was trying to break in and who was trying to sort of create a niche for herself also, essentially. But what's fascinating again is that, you know, there are also contradictions in the way she operates, because Kavi Singh claims to be a feminist. She claims herself to be, you know, this sort of person who's, you know, who values her independence, you know, who considers herself to be an equal to men and so on. But then, you know, she's also very happy to let her father and her husband or her ex-husband decide everything for her, right? So I remember I was talking to all of them and they told me how before Kavi Singh's career took off as a singer, her father and her brother used to essentially sit back and, you know, plan every bit of what Kavi Singh would look like, the artist. So, you know, right from the way she would speak to people, to the kind of songs that she would sing, to the kind of clothes that she would wear. They were the ones who were deciding all of this for her. And Kavi didn't have a problem with that. You know, Kavi said, I was fine with it. I didn't really care as much. So, you know, Kavi didn't really mind playing out the script that her father and her then husband wrote for her. But then what you see, and I don't want to give too much away, what you see is also sort of that contestation between Kavi, you know, whose sort of identity as a woman, it does clash with the ambitions of the men around her. And then that takes her down some very unexpected paths as well. So it's fascinating to see how she sort of, you know, negotiates that gendered equation within the Hindutva space. But what is key to note is that the way she dresses, and for an international audience who might not have the context, she dresses like a male politician or a male spiritual guru, which is that she wears these, you know, sort of long kurta. She will wear a pajama. She will wear a jacket. It's, you know, it's typically associated with male political leaders, that kind of jacket. And she'll wear a turban. Now, this whole ensemble, this whole outfit is very uncommon in women in India. So she does strike out as someone who's very different from your average woman who's walking on the streets. But you know, that is the essence. I mean, that she's trying to create a niche for herself in this male-dominated world, but also by emulating some of the things that she sees men doing, which is, you know, which is their outfits, which is also sometimes their rhetoric, because she can be very, very hard sometimes on issues. So it's a very interesting space that she operates out of, Pooja.
Does Hindutva pop music feature in memes or in Indian online culture? And the reason why I'm asking this is, strangely enough, when I, obviously as an outsider, somebody who is not deeply familiar with Indian culture, let alone languages, what I was struck by, even in months previous working with Pooja, what I was struck by listening to some of the Hindutva pop that I would listen to on YouTube, it reminded me, and this might sound strange, it reminded me a lot of what's called turbo folk music from Serbia and the Balkans, this sort of extremely Islamophobic music that even some of the music, I actually had I was talking to a journalist friend from the former Yugoslavia a few hours ago, and I sent her a link to, you know, a popular H-pop song. And then she sent me back a message a few minutes later saying this exact part of the song, it even sounds like a 90s turbo folk song from the former Yugoslavia, like with cheap synthesizer music, auto-tune, things like that. And why I'm mentioning all these Serbian nationalist songs is because they have this outsized presence in online internet culture, well outside of Serbia. There was a 14-year-old US boy who he was attempted a shooting at a school. And before one of his last social media posts, he wrote the title of, in Serbian, which obviously is a language he didn't speak, you know, song, he posted the title of one of these songs. So the Christchurch terrorist, of course, infamously on the way to his instigate his massacre, his terrorist act, he was listening to a song glorifying Serbian war criminal Radovan Karadzic on the way to the massacre. So that's a long way of pointing out that these kinds of relatively obscure Serbian nationalist songs have this presence in memes and online culture. And I'm wondering thus if Hindutva pop has that sort of presence in meme culture and online culture in the Indian context.
Oh, yes, absolutely, Michael. I mean, I think that's just absolutely fascinating concept. And it's something that I've said in the book as well, that that essentially, you know, the power of popular culture and the power of music in radicalizing people, in radicalizing communities, especially through the internet, has been rather underestimated. And I think there's an urgent need for us to sit and sort of study it in greater detail, because we've always sort of, you know, treated music to be this benign, almost harmless form of entertainment or of pleasure. But actually its power to radicalize has been ignored for the large part. And, you know, we're seeing this in case after case. I mean, in my own book, I briefly touch upon what happened in Rwanda with Simon Bikindi. You know, he was a popular singer of Rwanda at that point. And his songs, and this is one of the lesser known aspects of the genocide, is that his songs were very crucial in radicalizing people, in motivating them to commit acts of heinous violence. And similarly is the case in Myanmar, where we're seeing, you know, the genocide against Rohingya Muslims had, at least in some part, been driven by, you know, sort of this popular culture consisting of popular music, which was aimed against Rohingya Muslims and questioned their place in Myanmarese society and so on. So, you know, we've seen enough and more instances of that happening. And India is definitely not the first place where it is happening. As far as the you know, the memes part of it is concerned, I think, again, what makes Hindutva pop so pervasive and so sort of wide-reaching is that it's been... It gets repackaged multiple times. So I spoke to you at the start of the podcast about that procession, where essentially we saw how that procession was almost, you know, weaponized and it became a riot of sorts. So from that procession, the same song would travel on to, you know, political rallies sometimes, right? The same song then travels on to YouTube, where multiple versions of that song are created. And then the same song will travel onto your WhatsApp. It'll travel onto, you know, public buses where I've heard them being played. It will travel onto people's ringtones and caller tunes where they prefer to keep such songs as that. And then it also travels on to becoming, you know, sort of the background music for some very, very hardline memes, which essentially, again, you know, stoke the Hindutva agenda, which stoke sort of anger and fear against Muslims. And these songs with their words become the perfect backdrop for visuals to go with it, right? So the same song is then used in so many multiple spaces and gets repackaged in so many different directions that it's essentially very difficult to keep track of its reach in that sense. You know, but then again, that is what also makes it so important as a potent form of radicalization for all of us to look at and for all of us to track that.
You mentioned the visuals, and you segued perfectly into a question that I wanted to ask. Was one of the things that I focus on or obsess over with researching, investigating the far right is visual propaganda. So things, especially in public, especially graffiti, stickers, street art, things that are more obvious to things that are less obvious. Is there anything comparable to this in the Indian context? Like in a small city, can someone be exposed constantly to like visual manifestations or propaganda of Hindutva, even if it's sometimes subtle and not always something people are always going to immediately notice?
Well, so one of the things that has happened, you know, in the last couple of years or so, especially, is that our streets are way more sort of, you know, explicit in terms of the presence of Hindu right-wing organizations, right? Where Hindu right-wing organizations have gotten so emboldened that they will ensure that their flags are everywhere, their banners are everywhere. And the banners sometimes have very explicit messaging as well. You know, so for instance, not too far away from the international airport in Bombay, in Mumbai, which is the financial capital of the country, which is where all of the big corporations have their headquarters in, not too far away from the airport's entrance, is this massive banner that has been unfurled by one of the Hindu right-wing organizations, which says a nation for Hindus, a Hindu first nation, you know, the word saying Hindu Rashtra. Right, which is very openly sort of provocative in its own way. It doesn't sound very subtle at all. Right, so there's that. I mean, there's also this slogan, which was inherently actually a deeply religious sort of slogan, and almost used to greet each other. It was called Jai Shri Ram, which is, you know, sort of hailing Lord Ram. But that has again been weaponized and sort of, you know, taken in by the Hindu right wing, and it's so, I mean, you know, the irony of it is that there have been so many instances where there has been violence inflicted against, you know, people of other religious minorities, while the mob, which is the Hindu right wing mob, is chanting Jai Shri Ram. So, you know, Jai Shri Ram has been weaponized in that sense, and you find you know, Jai Shri Ram banners everywhere now as well. So, you know, there are these sort of signs that Hindutva is alive and that Hindu right-wing organizations are very, very present and active in those spaces.
It's fascinating how so many things are much more similar than I think a lot of people might realize.
Yeah, and on that note, you know, since you're talking about visuals, you know, how do you think this like propaganda music has changed with social media? Because nationalist music it isn't new. It has existed at least since the early 90s. But what used to be propagated, you know, via cassettes or radio, you know, these singers have platforms like Spotify or YouTube. So can you talk a bit about how social media has you know, helped them proliferate the content?
Oh, absolutely, Pooja. I mean, you're bang on the money when you say that it's not new at all, in the sense that we've seen iterations of this in the past as well, especially in the late 80s and the early 90s, when the movement to demolish these you know, this 14th century mosque in Ayodhya had caught steam, and then it led to violence across the country. We saw that there was similar music that had been created in bits and pieces by individual singers here and there. What we are now seeing is something very different, which is that this industry has now really become an industry. So essentially what has happened is that, you know, from the past where these were, you know, these sort of sporadic songs that were created depending on the mood of the nation, what we're now seeing is that has transformed into this industry with a very well-oiled mechanism in place where, you know, where there are people, where there are poets who write music and poetry, especially for these songs. There are singers who, like Kavi Singh, who made a career out of singing these songs. There are organizers who host concerts where they call the likes of Kavi Singh and, you know, get them to perform them. These songs are now, as I said, the mainstay at so many different religious and cultural occasions in India, as well as occasions like, you know, like a cricket match, for instance, right? So these songs are now everywhere in the country. They're no longer the purview of only a sort of events which are conducted by the Hindu right wing. These songs have gained mass popularity in so many ways. What we're also seeing is the next part of it, which is that as a result of you know, all of these artists using social media very, very actively and very proactively in some ways, where they're using social media platforms, especially platforms like YouTube, to be the host of these songs. You know, they're creating videos for these songs to go with it and so on. What has happened is that they've been able to reach more and more, you know, audience members and more people, and gain the following of millions of people as a result of social media. But there's another aspect to it that we sometimes miss out on, which is that YouTube hasn't only allowed them to reach a wider audience. YouTube, as a result of its monetization policies, has also served as one of the key sources of revenue for so many of these Hindutva pop artists. And the same is with you know, streaming audio streaming platforms like Spotify, like Apple Music, like Google Music, and so on. Right. So all of these have become a very active source and streams of revenue for these Hindutva pop stars. And I would like to single out YouTube only because, you know, the kind of money that they get from, you know, from a YouTube is very, very substantial. And it's so substantial that I don't mind sort of going a step ahead and saying that platforms like YouTube are no longer just facilitating or hosting these songs. They're in some ways actively funding these songs. Because what's happening is that as a result of the money that these artists are making on YouTube, they're taking that money and they're investing in it back into the art, you know, and back into the songs and the in sort of the recording equipment, the bettering of their videos that they shoot and so on. So essentially YouTube is saying, you know, come here, host your songs, host the rhetoric that you have against Muslims and Christians, and I'll give you more people, I'll give you more reach, and I'll give you more money for you to go on and do the same in a bigger and a bolder fashion in some ways. Right. So that is essentially what the role of social media has been when it comes to especially music and poetry.
I think it's interesting that you mention YouTube in such you know, length, because we had also done a story at Bellingcat on the role of YouTube, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but YouTube also auto generates these songs. Like, you know, these artists no longer have to, you know, even upload this content themselves. They can send it to YouTube on bulk, and YouTube uploads them. And also, when I spoke to one of the artists who's sort of popular on YouTube, and I asked him, you know, does YouTube help with, you know, your popularity? And he said, you know, absolutely. Several companies approached me to make songs because I, you know, because of the eyes that, you know, YouTube bring. And if a new studio is inaugurated, they will contact me to make songs. So I think, yeah, like it's not just, you know, them making songs, but I think it also comes from them getting new business because of YouTube. The popularity also brings more work.
But absolutely, Pooja. I mean, I can't agree any more with you, because what I saw, interestingly, is that the online and the offline feed into each other so beautifully. They're so intertwined with each other. That more number of subscribers for all of these artists on YouTube means they get more people coming to them, more organizers coming to them, asking them to perform in concerts, right? And the more the number of subscribers on a YouTube means the higher the money they charge for their concerts. So, and then when they go to these concerts, they direct all of these people onto their YouTube. So essentially, both of the online and the offline keep feeding into each other. And that cycle keeps, you know, keeps moving on and on. And the artist is benefited, and so is YouTube. So they're both locked into this very mutually beneficial relationship, which of course is endangering, you know, so many millions of people as a result of the rhetoric that it allows.
Switching gears a little bit, I just have one or two final questions to ask. Well, I think in theory, I actually have like 20 questions I could ask you, but we only have so much time, and I'll probably have to check in with you later about some of the other questions I might have. We've talked obviously about how Hindutva works in India proper, but how does it function in the diaspora? I'm from Canada, which has, you know, like some other countries, a very sizable Indian diaspora. And as I click open news stories to look right now, I'm reminded of the, shall we say, tensions between Modi's government and the Canadian government right now. But yeah, how does Hindutva work in the diaspora?
It's a fascinating question. And in fact, you know, it's something that I'm very deeply wanting to, you know, investigate and interrogate a lot more, because I think we don't necessarily understand sort of the transnational, the transnational form and the shape of Hindutva in that sense. We often mistake it to be, something that is purely a national phenomena in that sense. And it's actually, you know, cutting across borders. What a lot of people don't really know is that Hindutva in that sense and Hindutva organizations have been active in especially in the diaspora since the migration of a lot of Indians who went from the west coast of India, to Africa, to countries like Uganda and so on. And then when they were migrating is when sort of that sense of community started building up, and the Hindu right wing was very quick to enter that space and sort of to lodge its tentacles there. And so as a result of that, the community grew. And then when that same community migrated to countries like the UK, for instance, after all of the tensions in that part of Africa, so did the Hindutva community. So as a result of it, the new migrants that came to the UK brought Hindutva with them. And that has become this sort of fascinating story of how Hindutva has developed over the years. And essentially what all of these networks have done is not just to, not just to keep the agenda of Hindutva alive, but to also become a very major source of funding for Hindutva activities in India and for the BJP in so many ways. This is something that has been spoken about in the past, about how the BJP looks at, sort of these diaspora communities a lot for support in various different ways. So what has essentially happened is that in so many ways, Hindutva organizations initially started being, these spaces for a lot of socio-cultural interaction. And that is how they managed to lodge themselves into different diaspora communities. And then over time, they've built themselves up more and more and more to not just reflect socio-cultural sort of, movements or the desires or the needs of those communities, but then to also very actively stoke and to serve up a political agenda. And one of the most sort of recent examples of how potent Hindutva is abroad is, if you remember, in the UK a couple of years ago in 2022, we saw riots between Hindu and Muslim communities in Leicester in the United Kingdom. And a lot of it, and I wrote about it and I investigated that too a bit, a lot of that was also owing to the increasing Hindutva rhetoric that investigators found in the migrant Hindu community in India, in the UK, I'm sorry. So we're seeing that the global footprint of Hindutva is only growing more and more as time passes.
The final question I have for you is starting with a quote from yourself, the last sentence of the book.
But Michael, can I just quickly add to that point?
Go right ahead.
Especially because it sort of connects to Hindutva pop culture again, is that at the start of the conversation, I also told you guys that there was this sort of fourth frontier of Hindutva pop culture, which is Hindutva cinema. In the last couple of years, we've seen a glut of sort of these movies that have come, which again, take the Hindutva line and fan anger and hate against, especially Muslims. And two of those films, they're the Kashmir Files and the Kerala Story, right? Both of these films sort of targeting the Muslims, one based in Kerala, another in Kashmir. Both of these films were screened at a number of places in different diaspora communities. For instance, I can tell you about the UK. The community of Indians in the UK, now again, this is the invisible hand, but there were people who would sort of rent out massive theaters, and they would organize free screenings of these films to diaspora audiences there. So I know people in the diaspora there who showed me messages that they received from their local community saying that, oh, there's a free screening of this film, and we can also organize transport for you to take you from your home to the theaters and drop you back because you must see this film. So the Hindutva communities are also very well oiled in being able to support so much of this Hindutva pop culture that is being created, including music, including poetry, because some of these poets have massive diaspora followings. Some of these songs also are played in different diaspora events. And in fact, the third character in my book, who is a publisher of Hindutva books in India, he sells his books, you know, in different parts of the world, and he sells about 25,000 copies a year. I was introduced to him, Michael, as a result of my relatives who live in the UK, and they fund him for his activities, and they fund him because they see him as a cultural Hindutva warrior fighting the good fight for the Hindutva cause. So this is the power of the diaspora community when it comes to Hindutva right now.
I mean, that speaks to one of the main things that's fascinated me as I've learned more and read about Hindutva and the RSS and this whole ecosystem, is just how well organized it is, especially when I try to compare it to other sorts of movements in a quote-unquote Western context. It's really something. So I just have one kind of final question for you. You say your last sentence in the book, you say grimmer days are upon us. So you don't exactly strike an optimistic tone, but to be fair, I'm not always that optimistic about a lot of things these days either. But that being said, what needs to be done to try and push back against what seems like, you know, like pushing back against a tide? What can be done?
Well, I mean, you know, Michael, I say that with a lot of responsibility and with a lot of care for the detail. What we've essentially seen is sort of, you know, communalism as we've known it used to have a very different form in the past, right? Which was more episodic. That tensions between Hindus and Muslims have had a historical context. There has been a lot of baggage that both communities in India have carried, and you know they've not always been in a peaceful, harmonious coexistence with each other. But those tensions were always episodic, right? So they were always around events that would happen, which would stoke tensions, and then as days would pass, the tensions would recede, and the two communities would come back to each other. What we are seeing now, especially with Hindutva pop, is something very different. What we are seeing now is that sense of communalism, that sense of radicalizing, you know, people against the other community, is now a continuous everyday process, which has been masked under this benign seeming Hindutva pop culture, right? So you can be listening to music, you can be listening to poetry, you can be reading a book, and you can essentially be entertained while you're actually being radicalized against people of a different community. And this is something that we've never seen in the past. We've never seen this easy sort of bite-sized almost communalism that is so easy to access, that, you know, that it's shaping people's perspectives. You know, Hindutva pop culture is not just about what happens today. It's re-looking at our past. It's recasting it in a different light. And it's asking people to reimagine the future that they want to see for a country like India. You know, they're actively goading people into violence against Muslims. The idea always is to, you know, make this anti-Muslim bias within the minds of its audience a permanent feature, as against this episodic feature that it used to be. So each time you see a Muslim on the street, that bias, you know, can get activated very easily, because that's all you've been fed for days and days and days. And which is why I say that grimmer days are upon us. But, you know, a journalist can't be pessimistic. A journalist can't be cynical. And I continue to have hope that India will sort of get out of it. One of the things that we must, for instance, taking off from our conversation that we must push for is more accountability from our social media platforms, is more accountability from our streaming platforms, right? What we typically see in India is that all of these major platforms carry this sense of hypocrisy where they will agree to a certain set of rules and a certain set of behavior in countries like the US and the UK or in Europe. But the way that they behave in a country like India is very, very different, right? So their refusal to act on or to slow down the spread of hate is mind-boggling, because, you know, in India is where you've seen how so much of this constant hate online has contributed to real-world violence. We've seen that link being drawn again and again. So one of the things that we have to do is call for more accountability at that end. The other thing that I keep telling people to do is to be a lot more discerning of the content that you're consuming, the pop culture that you're consuming, because you know, a lot of the people who first take to H-pop don't necessarily realize the inherent political value of this pop culture. You know, they often see this to be this, you know, this catchy song or this, you know, this sort of free-spirited poetry, which is taking a political position, but it's not meant to be political. You know, it's just one of those things. But I think through the book, I've been wanting to convey that there's a deeply political design to all of this pop culture. And I wish people, you know, become more discerning of the kind of content that they consume. So you know, broadly, this is what I hope the book will do. I hope that this poison of sectarianism, this poison of you know, pitting one community against the other, recedes from our minds. But I know that fight is a long one. I know that's not going to happen overnight.
Thank you so much, Kunal. That was a fascinating talk. And if you're updating your book, super excited to read the updated version, especially what's happening, you know, this close or during the elections. And of course, if you also delve into movies, since you've given us, you've briefly talked about it and the propaganda that it adds to the larger pop culture ecosystem in India. Thank you so much for joining us and for your interesting insights.
That is a great suggestion, Pooja. I will definitely take that up at some point. but thank you so much for having me, guys. It's been a fabulous conversation. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Pooja.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast. If you want to keep up with what the far right is up to around the world, make sure to check out the monitoring team's latest investigations on our website, bellingcat.com. The Bellingcat Monitoring Podcast is produced by Michael Colburn and Charlotte Marr for Stitching Bellingcat. The music you've heard is called Lie by Daisy Chain and is courtesy of Artlist.